My husband has been abusing me and my kids for years. For a decade, I stayed with him because I was terrified of him getting visitation alone with the kids and what he would do to them. I consulted with a lawyer who told me that 50-50 custody was a very real possibility, regardless of how abusive he had been. She told me that the system is biased against women, doesn't believe us, and that our stories of abuse work against us. My husband found out, and he told me that if I ever left him, he'd call the police and tell them I molested the kids. I believe he's capable of it, and based on the stories I hear of women in the justice system, I believe I could be convicted of a crime that never happened. Please tell your listeners that women in abusive relationships stay for a reason, and that most of the reason involves our broken legal system. Hi, I'm Zahn Vilines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, we are going to talk about how the legal system victimizes and wrongly punishes women. Before we get started, as always, I'd like to ask you to leave a positive review on your favorite podcast platform and a heart react if you are listening on Substack. These reviews and heart reacts are critical to the success of the podcast. They influence who comes on the podcast, where it appears in the algorithm and rankings, and whether the podcast ultimately continues. This work is entirely free, and a quick review helps make it worthwhile to continue doing. If you really love this work, please consider becoming a paid subscriber. Paid subscribers get a bonus episode each month, 8 additional essays, access to a support group, free merch, and more. They also ensure that I never have to use advertisements and help me fund scholarships for people who cannot afford access. Subscribe at zahn.substack.com/subscribe. You can also find all of the books I mentioned on the podcast at the Liberating Motherhood Bookshop page, which also hosts tons of book recommendations and reading lists. Visit the page at bookshop.org/shop/liberatingmotherhood, and that's all one word. Today, I'm interviewing Velina Beatty. Velina, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Zahn.
I'm so excited to have you. So before we get started, I want to tell listeners a little bit about you. A wrongful convictions litigator and former federal prosecutor, Velina Beatty is the McKinney Professor of Law at Indiana University Bloomington Moir School of Law, and a co-founder of the Indiana Innocence Project. Her book, Manifesting Justice, received a gold medal in women's issues from the Independent Publishers Book Award. And her course book, The Wrongful Convictions Reader, is used in classrooms nationwide to teach about wrongful convictions. Her latest book, Pink Crime, examines the criminalization of motherhood, pregnancy, and queer identity. She lives in Indiana with her wife, daughter, and tripod dog. I love that the dog is a part of this.
She's special. She's a big part of our family.
Now, did she start as a tripod or that came later?
No, she actually, right before our daughter was born, she was diagnosed with cancer in her leg and had her leg amputated. And the doctor said, she might have a year. But we really think that our daughter has kept our dog going, and our dog has now been with us for 3 years and is doing great. And shout out to all the tripods out there because they live their best lives. And I appreciate our whole family.
Oh, I love it. Well, I'm so excited to talk to you generally about the criminal justice system, but I want to focus on your most recent book, Pink Crime. So maybe we could get started by telling me a little bit about the book, why you decided to write it, what you think listeners need to know about it.
Yeah, thanks so much. I wanted to write this book because I am a queer woman, a queer mother. I'm married to another woman in my home state of Indiana, and Indiana has made queer identity illegal in a number of ways. It this year announced that Pride Month instead would be Nuclear Family Month. It has made abortion illegal in almost all situations, with very few exceptions. And it has gone after women who are pregnant for pregnancy crimes as well. And all of this really resonates with me because of my background litigating wrongful convictions. I've represented women and queer people who have been wrongfully convicted for the past 15 years. And I saw a pattern, which was that the folks I was representing were being charged and convicted where no crime occurred, where there was no crime. There was just a villainization of them, and a villainization of women in particular. I mean, 75% of women who have been wrongly convicted and exonerated in the United States were convicted where literally there was no crime, where there was a electrical fire and they were charged with setting an arson, where a child, tragically fell down a steep set of stairs and they were charged with murder. And that's exactly what is happening right now with the attention and prosecution against pregnant people, against mothers, and against queer people. So I thought this book was really important to respond to the current moment and say, hey, this has been happening before. Here's how we can stop this from continuing.
Well, I'm so glad you're writing it. I have been working with a woman for about a year, and I've spoken about her on the podcast before, who had a similar thing happen to her, where she was prosecuted for something that was not a crime. Her baby was born with a rare birth defect that caused a brain injury. And at the time of the birth of her baby, she was in an abusive relationship with an absolutely horrible man. And so, as soon as the baby was born, and as soon as CPS started kind of sniffing around the family, he immediately turned against her and just made up all kinds of things about her. And it's been a year-long fight for her to get her baby back, for her to not go to jail. All of this because of something that was tragic that she didn't cause. I wonder if you would talk a little bit more about these prosecutions where no crime has occurred, because it's really scary.
And it's particularly scary when you see how healthcare providers are working with social workers, are working with the police against pregnant women and against mothers. What you have shared, I have seen many times, where women go to the hospital and give birth, and then the next thing they know, if there's a health challenge for the child, the child is taken away by Child Protective Services. Child Protective Services is called, police are called. In my local hospital here, where I gave birth, I received a phone call about a woman who had had a difficult labor, and had to be given some pain relievers for I think for an emergency C-section. And she was also drug tested because these hospitals do mandatory drug testing. And so she was drug tested. And of course, the painkiller was in her system. Of course, it was. The hospital had given it to her. Nevertheless, the hospital called Child Protective Services. Police were notified. The child was taken away from the parents, fortunately, only for a short period of time. But the mother was, aghast. She was like, you gave me the painkillers. You gave me the drugs that you found in my system. And the response of the hospital was, well, we don't know that. We don't know that you didn't come in here and already had taken some opioid. We don't know that. So that's how all of this can come together when there's really no crime at all. And it's playing on stereotypes about women as bad mothers. And as you were just saying, it can also be a tool for domestic violence. And I've seen that as well, where just like you were saying, the abusive partner will lie about the mother and will say that the mother caused the abuse when they're really in instances like you were just talking about, where it's a health condition, where for example, it's a short fall out of a crib, or it's rickets. And these lies then lead to these women not only being charged, but tragically, sometimes wrongfully convicted as well.
I want to talk a little bit more about these drug tests in the context of pregnancy and birth. My husband and I had an interesting experience when I was pregnant with our third child because he had to have his gallbladder removed about a month before I gave birth. And so we got his medical records after his like gallbladder crisis. And of course, when you have a gallbladder removal, you go in really sick and your liver enzymes are all elevated and all this kind of stuff. And they didn't drug test him, which is interesting to me because heavy drinking and drug use can cause your liver to fail and can cause gallbladder issues. So I just sort of noted that as a data point. And then a month later, when I gave birth, they did drug test me. And I was just incensed by this fact because to me, it felt like purely by virtue of being a woman, I have given up some right to not being searched. And now I have to treat my doctor like the police. And I'm like the most boring, straight edge person ever. I don't use drugs. I've never used drugs. So it wasn't that I was scared. It felt like a really intense privacy violation, especially in contrast to my husband, who had just had this real medical crisis that didn't warrant drug testing. Can you talk to me a little bit, like as a lawyer, about why this is allowed, or even if it really is or should be allowed? Like what's going on here?
Well, in a number of places now, the hospital will ask for your consent. So, among a stack of papers that you're signing when you're admitted to the hospital to give birth, there can be a paper there that says, "Do you consent to drug testing?" So, a number of people just sign that without even thinking twice about it. To your point, oh, there's nothing to be found. There's no harm here. Of course, I'll sign it, and that. Leads to situations like we were just talking about when the hospital is the one that gives you the drugs. Or, for example, you have a prescription. You take prescription medication that's assigned to you, and yet comes up in these tests that are not always reliable tests, and is used against you. So the Fourth Amendment is intended to protect against unreasonable searches and seizures of individuals. And it should protect women who are in the hospital. And yet, we've seen doctors and nurses not only turn over medical files, but allow police right into the emergency room, right after a giving birth, within half an hour of giving birth, being able to come in and interrogate mothers. So it's a space where hospitals are not protecting patients as much as they should from police.
Yeah, it's just outrageous because to me it seems like doctors should be protecting you from police because we all know that the police are a threat to everyone's health and well-being in the wrong circumstance. This urine drug test thing to me feels like sort of the criminalization of motherhood or of womanhood, particularly since we're not doing it to every man who comes into the hospital. And one of the things that you talk about a lot in your book is the criminalization of identity and how certain identities are more suspect or are weaponized against folks or are just used as grounds for prosecution. Can you tell me how that happens and what that looks like?
Yeah, and to build off of kind of the cases we've been talking about, we could look at Rennie Gibbs, who was a teenager, single mom in Mississippi, black woman. And when she gave birth and tragically gave birth to a stillbirth, the prosecution and the police just focused in on her as this is a quote unquote bad mom. This is a woman of color. This is a woman who is, really working financially to make things work as a single mom, and then isn't able to have a healthy birth, isn't able to have a healthy pregnancy. And that's often held against women, even though miscarriages happen in up to 1 in 4 pregnancies, and those are generally from genetic problems, it's still held against the woman, held against the pregnant person. And if it's a marginalized person, in race, in gender, in sexual orientation, in class, in disability, if they're marginalized in some way, then that just increases this focus of prosecutors and police that this person is a bad mother. This person didn't want to be a mother and therefore killed their child, which is an extreme jump to make that this person is a murderer and murdered a baby. But that's the allegation they're making. So to go back to Rennie Gibbs, she has this stillbirth. Prosecutors charge her with homicide. They have a forensic pathologist who says, "Oh, there were drugs in her system. That's what caused the death of this baby." And in reality, what the forensic pathologist, forensic expert failed to share and disclose was that the baby was born and had its umbilical cord around its neck. That is what led to the stillbirth. That is what led to the death. Was that ever shared with the jury? No. Was that ever shared broadly when these charges were being brought? No. So those are the kinds of situations where we see this real targeting. Why would prosecutors who know that information bring charges of murder? Why would they do it? And it's because of Rennie Gibbs's identity.
Yeah, I mean, I'm listening to the story and I'm just like, why would they do it? And really trying to understand kind of like the psychology behind it. I think that one thing I'm struck by is how victim blaming functions to like separate us from other people.
Yes.
We had a baby who died, and what I was really struck by is that one of the first questions people would always ask us is like, well, did you get a vaccine while you were pregnant? Or did you use retinol while you were pregnant? What I realized is that it was so scary to people to think about the potential of a baby or a newborn dying that they wanted to find a way that it wouldn't happen to them. And so they wanted to find like something that we had done wrong. And so, you know, while that was like really enraging, it also showed me just how scared people are and how they will look for a way to make themselves feel safe. And I do feel like in a lot of these cases, some of that is at play, that like she's the wrong kind of woman. She did the wrong thing. Here's the wrong thing she did. And that's why that won't happen to me. And I think that makes sense as like a human impulse. But then we see how it's like baked into the legal system of like, okay, now we're going to find a reason that I'm safe. And then we're going to prosecute her for that reason.
Yeah, and
What do you see that happening? What do you think about that tendency?
so the criminal legal system is meant to provide safety. That is its purpose. And if people who are prosecuted are labeled and presented as dangerous and as a danger, then again, as you were just saying, then the community can feel more safe by that person being incarcerated. The community can feel protected. But if it's just a story of someone being a villain and it's not a reality, then we're not creating any safety. And you're absolutely right. I thank you for sharing your personal experience. And I mean, being asked, did you eat any fish while you were pregnant? What about unpasteurized milk? Just the list can go on and on and on about how pregnant people can do something wrong that could potentially cause some kind of harm while ignoring, again, that to talk about miscarriages, the majority of miscarriages are genetic problems, genetic issues that are tragically happening. And then once a child is born, that's where we have a number of these cases where it's such a tragedy for a baby and a young child to die. It's such a tragedy, and we can't handle that individually as a society. It makes us feel safer to have someone to blame rather than that sometimes children and babies just don't make it, or there's an accident, or again, there's a tragic shortfall. That's really, really scary. Like you just said, Zahn, that's really scary. And it feels less scary to hold, again, a woman, a mother accountable instead. And what compounds that is that these women often blame themselves. Even when they had nothing to do with the death of their child, they still will blame themselves. I should have done something. I should have been able to save my child. I should have been able to protect my child. And so they'll take on that responsibility. And then prosecutors and police turn that into a confession. And then we see a wrongful conviction where truly the mother has done nothing to harm the child.
Yeah, I see a lot of parallels between that and abusive and violent relationships where the woman who's in the abusive relationship blames herself for the relationship, or she doesn't really fully recognize it as abusive because she thinks she deserves it. And then that behavior is used as a signal that she wasn't really abused, or maybe that she did deserve it. And we're seeing the same thing with these women where they're natural impulse to feel guilty and devastated, and to maybe kind of feel hopeless, is used as a sign that, well, she deserves to feel those feelings because she caused it. I guess I'm thinking about, how our legal system like bakes bias into itself, and also what we might be able to do to counteract that bias. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I mean, thank you for your ongoing discussions about criminalized victims, and how when women are victimized in many different ways, the criminal legal system then uses that against them and uses that, to your point, as evidence that they, quote unquote, deserve some kind of punishment. I mean, one of the worst things that I would hear when I was a prosecutor was, well, if she didn't do this, she did something else. This idea that because of who this woman was, she quote unquote deserved punishment, regardless of whether she had committed the offense that was charged or not. And one of the things we don't talk about much, and July is Disability Pride Month, is mothers with disabilities and how often mothers who have a disability lose their child to Child Protective Services for no reason other than the fact that they have that disability. Women who give birth, and the first person who is there to talk to them after giving birth is a social worker. And again, just as many women with disabilities are having children as women who do not have disabilities. And yet, because we do not provide accessible prenatal care, because we have doctors and nurses who, again, chastise, demonize mothers who have a disability and have a child, that comes together to often separate children from a disabled mother. So I think that's something we don't think about enough or talk about enough, that that bias, that stereotype, is, to your point, so baked in that doctors and nurses have no shame in directly saying to a disabled parent, "You can't be a parent. I'm calling Child Protective Services." No shame in that at all. So that's one example I wanted to give, particularly for Disability Pride Month.
Yeah, I really appreciate you pointing that out. It's timely because there is a disabled writer who I follow, and I actually saw on her Facebook today this morning that some troll had reported her to Child Protective Services. And what their report was she's disabled and she shouldn't have a child. And to me, a functional Child Protective Service system would immediately screen out that report and say, well, it's from someone who doesn't even know her and no. But instead, they came to her house and they went through her stuff and they asked for letters from her doctors. And I think they wanted something from like the child's therapist. And, all of this has a cost to her. And did they take her kid? No. But was there a threat that they might? Like, absolutely. And unapologetically, because and solely because she's disabled.
Yes, and thank you for sharing that. And we see this for disabled moms. We also see this for queer parents. So also what was in the news recently was Pete Buttigieg, who is a fellow Hoosier like me from Indiana, and he's a married gay man and has twins that are 4 years old. And to your example you just gave, there was an anonymous report filed with Child Protective Services against him, saying that he wasn't fit to be a parent, that he was harmful to children. And essentially, it was because he was gay. This was a anonymous, likely politicized report that CPS did investigate, came to his home, came with police, The children had to stay somewhere else away from him for 24 hours, had to be interviewed on their own. He wasn't able to have contact with them, thankfully for a short period of time, and it ended up going nowhere. But it crushes your belief in, going back to our criminal legal system and safety, it crushes your belief in that safety. You're like, I am no longer one of the people who is being protected by our criminal legal system. I am being targeted, and I am being targeted by our family policing system as well. So it also happens with queer individuals, and frankly, marginalized parents generally.
So you spoke a little bit about how prosecutors respond to people, and you were a prosecutor, and I don't get to talk to former prosecutors a lot. And I would love to get your insight into what's going on the prosecution side of a lot of these cases, because, I've been working with and talking to women in these situations for years and years, and from the outside looking in, the behavior of some of these prosecutors looks absolutely unhinged. But I know that people generally don't say, "Hey, I'm going to wake up this morning and abuse someone." They say, "Hey, I'm going to wake up this morning and I'm going to go fight for justice," and that these prosecutors really think they're doing the right thing. What's going on? What's the thought process that gets this going? Because I think if we can maybe understand that, then we could maybe start to untangle that a little bit.
Thanks for this question, Dawn, because this is one of the key things I talk about in my book, Pink Crime, and that is what's referred to in the law as tunnel vision. So when prosecutors or police will just focus in on one theory of a case, will just focus in on one suspect, and there's tragic, tragic stories of wrongful convictions where, because the police and prosecutors focused in on one person, Felina, for example, they missed the true perpetrator who then went on and committed other offenses. So, this tunnel vision is when there's so much commitment to one idea, one story of how this, tragedy unfolded, that prosecutors and police ignore any evidence that would undermine it. They only look at evidence that supports their theory of the case. And this is tied to the fact that prosecutors often feel like they have to be right. They usually win their cases, and they are the white knight. They are the protectors, and they, again, have this belief that they are going to be correct in their case. And when you couple that with how prosecutors are often truly overworked and have a lot of cases, then it's just a toxic combination where they don't have much time to spend on the case. They focus in on one person as a perpetrator, as one idea of how, for example, a harm happened to a child, how their health condition happened, and that's it. And then they focus on that and they pressure the person to plead guilty. 90 to 95% of cases in the US end in guilty pleas. So that includes innocent people who plead guilty. So it's all tied together in this. And I'll just give one example, which is, I now see a lot of ways that faulty forensic evidence, like fire science evidence, is used to wrongly convict people. But when I was a prosecutor, I didn't see that. I didn't know that information. I just knew this is evidence that is going to convict the defendant, and I have an expert, and I'm going to make sure I ask the expert the right questions where they'll say, yes, 100%, without a doubt, it's that defendant. That's what I cared about. I didn't look into whether the evidence was reliable. I didn't look into whether my expert had additional information or there was a different view on it. I just looked at what I needed to get the conviction.
It's so interesting, and it's also so scary. So I want to focus a little bit more, since this is a podcast about mothers and motherhood and oppressive maternal norms, on the construction of the unfit mother. So when I was getting ready for this interview, I found a paper that you just published that I loved, and I want to quote from it because it's so amazing. So here's the quote that I pulled. 74% of known exonerated women were wrongly convicted where no crime occurred. Similarly, in criminalizing pregnancy behaviors, police, medical personnel, or prosecutors erroneously label a non-criminal event, such as a miscarriage or stillbirth, as criminal. Criminal charges are being brought against new mothers who test positive for their own legally prescribed medicine, for morphine that was given to them by the hospital for pain during labor, or for a controlled substance when the child is born healthy and unharmed. This article conceptualizes reproductive wrongful convictions and exposes how marginalized women are being labeled as unfit and are particularly vulnerable to these charges. Historically and today, the label unfit applies to women with disabilities, as well as women from race and class subordinated communities. That's the end of the quote, and it just sums up the issue so well. And one thing that I kind of wanted to focus on with this concept of an unfit mother is that I have this really popular piece I published a couple of years ago that I called Welcome to Motherhood, Fuck You. And the piece was about how in patriarchy, there's not really a way to be conceived of as a good mother. No matter what you do, you're doing it wrong. Someone has a problem with it. If you breastfeed, you're breastfeeding wrong. If you formula feed, you should have breastfed. However you give birth, it's wrong. However you discipline or don't discipline your kids, it's wrong. And so I think it's important for all mothers to realize that in a patriarchal society, we can all be painted as unfit mothers. And like, that's not an accident.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that you can do everything in your control, and still, if something goes wrong with your pregnancy, if something goes wrong with your birth and your birth plan, you will be blamed simply because you are the mother, you are the pregnant person. There will be a way to blame you. And if that's because it makes other people feel more comfortable to have someone to blame, then maybe that's one reason. But your identity can be used against you, and something can be found in what you've done. Again, whether it's were you always wearing a seatbelt? Did you rest enough? Did you walk enough? Did you provide certain foods, or not provide certain foods? There's always some reason that the mother can be blamed. And you're right that that's directly tied to the patriarchy. That's directly tied to mothers having to take responsibility, not only for caring for a child, raising a child, caring for the home, taking care of the home, all of that labor, but also for health and wellness that is completely out of their control.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, they'll be blamed for whatever the man does. L literally, anytime I post anything on social media about abusive men, I will get inundated with comments that are like, and why do women just keep letting them get away with it? Like, we're responsible for our behavior, responsible for men's behavior, and we're responsible for the entire political landscape around us.
That's exactly right. And that's why it's so important that laws like were just passed in Oklahoma about criminalized survivors are crucial to trying to change this landscape, because we do see women who, when they try to fight back against their abusers, they're the ones who are criminally charged. We see women who, when they try to protect their children from their abusive partner, and they're not able to, they fail in protecting themselves and their children from their partner. They are the ones who are criminally charged and punished and sentenced to years in prison, not the abusive partner. So we see this happening, and it's part and parcel with this victim blaming. And I can only say, at least there is a movement now towards recognizing that these women are not to blame for what their abusive partners do. They are not the ones who are responsible for this. They are not going to make society safer by having them incarcerated. And I'll give one example, which is Melissa Lucio, who was wrongly convicted in Texas, where her toddler, tragically fell down a steep set of stairs. And Melissa herself was pregnant with twins at the time that she goes to the hospital with her toddler, and her toddler dies. And this is tragic. And then right from the hospital, the police take her to be interrogated. And not only do they present false evidence towards her, but they're like, you must have abused this child. You must have been the cause of this child's death. You must have done this. And in reality, it was her romantic partner who had been abusive. And he hadn't caused the child's death. The child's death was from the fall from the staircase. And yet they didn't look into him as the person who had caused the child's death. Even though he had a pattern of abuse, they didn't look into him. They looked into Melissa, who had no history of being abusive to any of her children.
So, okay, you mentioned this false evidence thing with her story, and I see this come up over and over and over again. The manufacturing of false evidence, the misconstrual of real evidence, where the people doing it have to know that they're lying. It's not just an accident or bias. It's a lot more malicious than that. What is the incentive structure that encourages this to happen? This seems to me to be a systemic problem. It's not just a few bad apples. What's going on that supports this?
Is absolutely a systemic problem because in the United States, police can lie to anyone they interrogate. In some states, we see growing protections for juveniles who are being interrogated by police, that police cannot lie to a teenager because we recognize that teenagers may be particularly susceptible. But for adults, for anyone in the United States, if the police ever arrest you and bring you in for questioning, they can lie to you. They can tell you there's medical documents that prove that you caused some kind of a harm. They can tell you that another witness saw you commit some kind of act. They can even say, well, maybe you did it while you were sleepwalking. Maybe you did it and you weren't fully aware of what you were doing. These are all ways for police to get confessions, especially if they're allowed to interrogate you for hours and hours and hours. So Melissa Lucio was interrogated middle of the night, right after her toddler's death, for hours, until by the end she finally said, I don't know what you want me to say. And she finally says, okay, I'll take responsibility for my child's death, even though she did not cause the death. So that is one of our systemic problems, is that police can present false evidence, false information for hours until finally obtaining what they would call and use as a confession.
The false confession thing is so interesting to me. I know there was that study several years ago of false confessions outside of a criminal context, where they were able to induce a large number of people to commit to crime, to admit to crimes that they didn't do and that never happened. I'll have to dig it up and put it in the show notes, but it was so compelling to read. And I think that we all have a chance to see in our own lives how easy it is to induce a false confession because if you interrogate your child for long enough, they'll say anything to make it stop. Or even if you try to make your child talk about their feelings for too long, they'll start telling you what they think you want to hear. So imagine if there's a gun and a jail. To me, it seems obvious that of course people are going to say whatever you want, especially when the police are often promising, "Oh, I'm going to help you out of this if you just confess."
Right. And you're also thinking, how can I get out of this right now to get home to my children, to be
Yes.
able to go back to work on Monday, to be able to keep my job? I need to get out of this as soon as possible. And I can always fix it. I'll just say what they want to hear and I can always fix it later. But instead, that is used again as proof that the person committed a crime when they didn't. So it is a very coercive setting. And I love your examples about false confessions because another study is simply asking people, oh, you went to Disney World recently. So did you see Bugs Bunny? Oh, you must have seen Bugs Bunny there. He was right by the front entrance. He was right there. You took a picture with Bugs Bunny. And the number of people who ultimately would say, oh, yeah, that's right. I did see Bugs Bunny. Oh, yeah, I did take a photo with Bugs Bunny. That's right. That's right. Bugs Bunny is Warner Brothers. Bugs Bunny is not Disney. There's no way Bugs Bunny would have been there. And yet, through that simple test, we're able to see how easy it is for people to falsely confess.
Yeah. So I actually did a test like this in my own life years and years ago. So my husband is a federal civil rights litigator, and so he works on some cases like this. And he came up with this scheme to sort of get people to better appreciate false confessions. And here's how it works. You try to induce a false memory in someone you love, and you even tell them that you're going to do that. So he did this to me. And he was going to create this false memory of this time I went to the fair, and there were these ducks following these geese, and they went down a water slide, and then they chased me. This like absolutely did not happen. And every now and again, he would just like bring it up, you know, that tell me about the time you went to the fair again. Just totally casual, not a high stakes conversation, just messing with my memory. And now I remember this as actually having happened to me, even though I know that it did not. Because our memories are just weird. Like our memories are not perfect recordings of our lives, and you can mess with people's memories in all kinds of ways. And I feel like that's something people aren't fully aware of.
Yeah, that's right. Our memories are malleable. They're not a perfect recording. I'll often ask my students, I'll say, okay, so think of an important day in your life, graduation or a marriage day, some day that's really important to you. And can you see yourself in that moment? Can you see yourself, dancing on the floor? Can you see yourself walking across the stage and getting that diploma? And I give them a few seconds. And then I say, if you can see yourself, it's a false memory because you could never see yourself and see what you are actually doing. That's something your mind has created of what happened in that moment. So again, our memories are indeed very malleable.
That's such a great simple experiment. I love that. And I think people should do that because I think it will cultivate more empathy for how people can be kind of induced to say anything. So my last question to you is kind of a big one, and in that regard, sort of a frustrating one, but I have to ask it anyway. And that is, what needs to happen to change this? What kinds of measures could make an immediate difference? What do we need long term? How do we begin fixing or rebuilding or destroying and then rebuilding the system?
So a lot of the answers that I think of come from our discussion today, ending deceptive police tactics in interrogations. We didn't even talk about how trauma can be such a factor in these interrogations as well. We alluded to it, but really recognizing the trauma that victims and survivors are going through and how that is used against them when they're being interrogated. Curbing faulty forensic evidence. So actually, challenging that evidence in court that often relies on defense attorneys. But it can also mean, we as individuals pay attention to our prosecutors and who is elected as our countywide or citywide prosecutor. So we have our elections coming up this fall, and oftentimes people don't pay as much attention to elected prosecutors. But those are the folks who are deciding a priority of our office is going to be to investigate miscarriages to see if they are abortions, if abortion is illegal in our state, and to bring criminal charges against those women. Those lead prosecutors, those elected officials are the ones who can create that culture for the office. So it really matters pushing those individuals for where they stand on bodily autonomy, for where they stand on how they prosecute parents and pregnant people, and then voting on that. So that's another area. Prosecutors' offices can also have conviction integrity units. And that is a unit that looks into past convictions to see if there was a wrongful conviction. So that can be important on the back end to go back and say, oh my gosh, these are innocent folks who have gone to prison because we have had this one police detective who has coerced individuals into false confessions, for example. So really being able to figure out where those problems are along the criminal legal system. So those are, a couple of ideas. My book ends with a whole chapter that talks to both people who are litigators, people who are social justice advocates, exonerees, and people who are social media influencers on how they see in their different roles they can challenge wrongful convictions. So I hope that folks will get a chance to pick up the book and to learn a bit more about what we can all do together.
So it's really a great book, and I have to add my own plug for it. So I'll do that. If you're not in publishing and you're not a writer, you may not know, one, how hard it is to write a book, and two, how hard it is to sell a book. So I'm going to tell you the thing that is probably the most important determinant of a book's success are pre-orders. So if you want to help Valina's book succeed and send a message that we care about these issues, that we want more feminist writing, that we want more investigative, progressive, legal writing, then you should pre-order the book. That helps it to succeed. I will put a link to the book. It's out August 4th, but you can order now. And I just really hope you will support this important work because these stories really, really need to get out. And
Dawn, thank you
Valina, thank you
so
so much for coming on. It's been wonderful
much. Oh
talking
my
to you.
gosh. Thank you. This has been such a really powerful conversation to have with you. And thank you. And thank you for your support of the book. And I do want to let listeners know there is a code TNP30, which stands for the new press, TNP30, for 30% off on pre-orders.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, can they use that anywhere, or do they have to go to a specific site?
They have to pre-order it from the new press.
Okay, I'll put a link to that website as well as the code. And yeah, please order, get it for gifts. It's really good, really well researched and well organized. And I hope that listeners will go out and buy it. Belina, thank you again. It's been so wonderful talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been really important and really moving. And thank you for everything you talk about on this podcast. And I'm so glad you have such a great supportive audience that wants to hear about this and learn more.
Yes, I have the best listeners. And listeners, I will be back with you in 2 weeks.